Hey, how you doing? This is Wade with Wade for Wireless. I hope you're having a great day because I got a lot to cover here. I'm going to get into it, but first I want to cover a few things like Tower Tracker Pro, one of my sponsors. And if you go to Wade for Wireless, WADE, the number four, wireless.com, you can see the link in there for Tower Tracker Pro. What they do, closeout packages. That's what they do. And the closeout package, anyone who works in the tower industry, you pretty well know what a closeout package is, but with Tower Climber, can do it on a smartphone, on a tablet, and it goes step by step through what they need. Not just the pictures, but the information, all the data, puts in everything, the GPS data, all that. Step by step by step. So you get it right first time, one site visit. But before they leave, they'll take that package and they'll upload it to somebody back in the office that can do quality control to make sure the pictures look right, make sure the quality's good. They don't have to resize it because the package does that for you. How cool is that? Tower Tracker Pro. Get your Tower Tracker Pro package for closeout packages today. That sounds like a pretty good ad, doesn't it? Second thing I want to thank, Tower Safety and Instruction. TowerSafety.com for all your tower safety instructional needs, including, obviously, tower safety and rescue, OSHA, CPR, first aid, and now they just added drone training for tower work. How cool is that? For tower inspections, and I hope someday we can use drones for closeout packages, but my God, these closeout packages are getting more and more complicated. I just can't believe. I mean, what do people want? You know why they do that? We'll get into that on these panels, but just because some contractors don't do their job properly. That's very important to think about as we talk about this conference. Finally, I want to cover the Wireless Deployment Handbook for Small Cells, CRAN, and DAS to show you the proper way for a deployment plan end-to-end. The reason I did this, because even if you don't work on it end-to-end, it helps give you an understanding of how the deployment rolls out, who you're handing off from, and who you're handing off to. That was my goal for this, and it really tells you a lot about the deployment. In fact, I had a few people come back and say it's underpriced, so I'm probably going to be raising the price on that soon. And finally, I am going to be at Nate Unite. That's right, for 2016. I'm actually recording this the week of Nate Unite, and I hope to get this out there, well, the week of. Actually, it's the Saturday before Nate Unite. Technically, that's the week before. Sorry, guys. My point is, I'm going to be there. If anybody's there, I'd love to meet and greet as many of you, unless you want to punch me or something. Then I'll back down. I just want to meet the friendly people. Going to be honest with you. Okay, let's get right into this. The second panel covers the OSHA RFI. That's very important to remember because I don't know if you remember a while back, OSHA put out an RFI, and you probably didn't read it in the blog because those were some of my lowest ratings ever on the blog. I think it was one of my lowest months ever. I was trying to promote the RFI, and in all honesty, Wireless Estimator did a really good job of recording the information and making it very easy, and it was great that OSHA and the Department of Labor and Wireless Estimator, the Wireless Estimator, could put something together. You could upload the information from them. And for all you climbers that were afraid that your boss would find out, you could do it anonymously. I mean, my God, I guess that's why I harped on it for a solid month, because I just couldn't believe, as much as people complained to me, that no one could put it in writing for OSHA. I mean, that makes it official. You can't go much higher than that. You want OSHA to know what's going on. Although, in all honesty, OSHA was pleased with the response. And I have all the links in there. I have the links from the results, the RFI response. I have the video to this conference. It's all in my blog at wadeforwireless.com. So I apologize. I'm going to fly through this, but I want to start. The moderators were Michael Jansen, Associate Chief, CIPD, WTB, FCC, and Aaron Patterson, Regulatory Analyst for OSHA. And the panelists were Craig Lakutis of wirelessestimator.com, Richard Collum, a PM for Crown Castle. He's a TIRAP board member, and he's a former client. You have Nick Vespa, Southeastern Towers. I'm assuming he's still a climber. He looked like a pretty healthy guy. And you have Dr. Bridget Hester, who runs the Hubble Foundation, which is a nonprofit foundation for the support of tower climbers' families, and specifically for tower climbers that get hurt or the fatalities, you know, people we lose, they support the families. She also does research into the industry and the problems with the tower climber. So Michael and Aaron opened the session by asking Nick to explain a picture he had. Now, this picture, which is in there, they do show it. I don't have a picture of it on my blog, but it's, if you watch a video, it's there. The picture is basically, you know, one of those towers. It looks like a guide tower because it's a skinny tower, and it's got like 20 dishes. I don't know. All right, realistically, let's say eight dishes all at one level. and it looks like it's impossible to climb around. And I've climbed towers like these. As a matter of fact, in Maryland, I want to say at Chesapeake College, there's a tower like that where they have all these dishes in one area. And it's just next to impossible to maneuver around. It's a lot of work. As a matter of fact, when we had situations like that, we used to send one guy up to rig a safety line, like a rope, you know, your rope grab. So you could use your rope grab to get around that. That way, if anything did happen, at least they'd get caught. Sorry, going off point. But that's what he was trying to do, is show you that many towers out there are not inducive to the tower climber, that they actually have so many obstacles the tower climber has to deal with. And that was his point. So Erin asked the panelists about how they felt about the RFI response. She did say that OSHA was pleased with the response regardless. Craig said the RFI was responsible, and he thanked everyone for letting wireless estimators serve their part in it. You could submit into that, into regulations.gov openly. So he thought it was really great that they could do that. And I have a picture of Craig and Richard and Nick and Dr. Hester in there if you want to see them. Now, Nick thought that, you know, it really helped get the word out. It really helped the climbers. Remember, the RFI was put out for everybody, not just Nate, not just the business owners. It was put out to the climbers. That's right. It was put out to people in the industry. That's what made it so monumental, so incredible. Anyone could actually fill that out. So that's very important to remember. And Dr. Hester thought that the responses were well thought out and pointed out how the schedule and pressures were brought to attention in the RFI. And the other thing, you climbers that complain about the carriers all the time, this was your chance to really complain about the schedules and the tough works and trying to get things completed and the health risks, things like that. Next, Michael then asked the board about the RFI feedback they got. And what he did, he pointed out specific questions. I tried to get them all right here, but he basically said here, the biggest problem is the rush that the carriers put on the GCs, GC for general contractor. We have a couple of weeks where we might not have any work. Then all of a sudden we get four sites and the companies expect these to be completed in a matter of days. We have to push our guys to the limits. So they work basically 2 weeks straight for 10 to 12 hours a day. Now, Nick said that's a great comment. And he sums up the main problem in the industry. You have timelines in these contracts that are basically unrealistic. What happens is it's a wait, hurry up, wait, hurry up, wait, hurry up type of system. And I think he was trying to point that out there, that the guys, you know, after they're working those long days for long times, they get fatigued. Richard then pointed out that because of all the delays up front, mainly permitting, that causes the tower workers to do more work in less time. And I bring this up all the time because here's what happens with a PM. I'm going to tell you right now. I'm going to tell you the psyche of a project manager in these jobs, or some of them, not all of them. Some project managers understand they can plan better, but some of these guys know they can't control zoning or permitting. They can't. They get frustrated because they can't do that. You know what they can control? The tower crew. You know why? Because they're human beings and they sit there and they beat on those guys. It's a common problem. ProPublica did a whole thing about it. Some of these guys put money before people. I'll get into that later. And that's actually covered in panel three. So Richard pointed out about all the delays up front that cause problems in the back. So then Michael read the next comment. Most safety issues are directly a result. So pressure from the wireless carriers, basically, okay, I'm going to just sum it up. Having a hard time reading today. Basically, here's what it says. Okay, let me sum it up here. I'm going to do the best I can. Most safety issues are directly related to a result of pressure from the wireless carriers to get the projects done in a very short time frame. Even though the field crews go through all the OSHA training, like Comtrain and other safety training, they feel the need to take shortcuts to get the job done by the due date specified by the carriers. This means they do not always adhere to the safety regulation purposely or too exhausted and overlooked steps to ensure that theirs and other safe working conditions are on job sites. So they're not looking into their safety or other climbers' safety. With all that said, Dr. Hester responded that she hears that from the field quite often. She says the problem is these directives come from the carriers down. Now, in all honesty, the carriers have no idea on the site. Quite frankly, they don't care. They just want the site up. Again, a lack of compassion. Don't just blame them. It's filtered down. Lack of compassion on down. Everyone wants to look like the hero that got it done. Chances are the PM's going to take credit for it. Any of you that deny that, it's just the way it is. She said she hears it all the time. She said that they constantly bring up that they do things like that. She also brought up that it might not be complacency, but acceptance, because complacency came up before, that these climbers get complacent. That came up in my panel, panel one. She doesn't look as complacent see as a problem, but maybe they just accept that they have to take shortcuts. They just accept they have to just hurry up and zip through this and get it done. Then Craig responded by not totally agreeing with Dr. Hester that the pressures are causing the fatalities, but instead The fatalities in 2014 were more about not knowing how to do the job. And I would imagine he's speaking about those guys that built the tower. In fact, he was. He was speaking about the guys that built the tower in West Virginia. And they just, you know, the tower came down. It killed two climbers. It killed a fireman when the second tower came down. It was just a disaster. Craig makes a good point. Those guys basically removed a lot of cross members without thinking. Now, whether they were poorly trained or ignorant or didn't know better, I don't know. It seems to me they didn't have a plan. And I remember at a conference I was out at IWCE last year, a Crown Castle guy asked me about that. And I said, well, your mechanical engineer should, or your, no, didn't mean mechanical, I meant structural engineer should be able to come up with a plan for that. But I later found out that a lot of structural engineers don't do that on purpose because they don't want the liability. Then Michael brought up is that we all have a responsibility to make this industry safer. Now that's part of the solution. And when he says all, that we talked about in panel one. It comes from the carriers, from the PMs, all the way down to the guy on the field. It's a team effort, people. We've been saying that. We got to create a culture of safety in this industry that not only spreads in just the company, when I say the company, owner, climber, ground guy. All those guys should be on the same page. Project manager, same page. The GC above them, same page. Safety first. And then the carriers have to really start that. So when the carriers start crying about the schedules, we have to say we'll do all that we can as fast as we can, as safe as we can. However, when the carriers start putting penalties in for getting things done late, then you got a problem. And when the contractors don't pay people, they go out and get 90% of the job done because they didn't have the parts, it's a real problem. Anyway, my opinion, sorry. Michael then brought up the next slide. When he brought these slides up, they were questions. So Aaron read it. The placement and positioning of equipment on the tower, however, probably has the greatest impact on the tower climber's ability to safely navigate through the hazards. Obstructions of the tower integrate safety components is certainly one of the more common examples of this. Mounts themselves are often heavily crowded with equipment and cabling configuration that can require climbers to take greater risks simply to access the equipment they need to work on. T-boom style mounts, for example, often greatly increase the difficulty for accessing the equipment by requiring the climber to execute the balance act, a long one. Hey, have you ever seen these T-boom mounts? Special note for me here. All it is, anyone who worked on monopoles and saw these 6-foot mounts that just, they're just a big solid steel beam. For a climber, they basically have to balance themselves to get out there. I've never seen any round ones. All the ones I've seen were rectangular, but I used to go out in those all the time. Why? Because quite frankly, I was the only one that would do it. And again, I'm part of the problem. Don't get me wrong, but I would usually have a rope grab. So if something did happen, I'd fall, though. Thank God nothing ever did. But these things, like we talked about in panel one, they're basically called the Widowmaker because they're just so dangerous. Why did they put them up? They were cheap. They were cheap. They're solid. They seem to work. You know, that's why they put them up. That's basically what this question was about. Like some of the problems when you're a tower climber, and this question, I'm going to just sum it up. This question is about not only do you have to deal with all the natural hazards, the weather or spiders, snakes, you know, all these natural hazards. You also have to deal with man-made hazards like these T-booms, you know, these Widowmakers they put out there. And we should really focus on making them safer. It's just like Nick pointed out in the very beginning. They put 30 dishes in one area, so you have to climb out and around it like it's a death trap. And I climbed a lot of those. It's just very frustrating. So first, Richard responded with the options to improve the safety of the employees by getting a man lift or other options. And Nick brought up that some towers do have a sign pointing this out. He mentioned that it's not enough. Richard then said that it's up to the contractor to figure out safety. He said that the construction project, that the contractor is fully responsible for safety, not the tower owner. I don't know about, that statement was powerful to me because I often wondered if you're in an apartment complex and something happens, don't they usually sue the owner? Do they sue the contractor? Does it filter down that way? Maybe I just don't know the legal system. Richard basically said, it's up to the contractor, not the tower owner. So then Michael then transitioned into a note from the RFI, another response. The issue is the use of a copier to make everyone a certification. Every employee that is hired would submit a certification that was copied from someone else's certification. Hey, I don't know if you remember, but I wrote a blog about this stating that your certifications don't go with you, but for some reason, they do. So anyways, Craig believes that the NWSA will resolve this certification problem that we see today. I'll get into that in a minute. Then Nick thought that the NWSA was doing a great thing. He verified that it's a common problem in the industry. Now, special note, the reason the NWSA certification is going to make a difference because they're going to have certifications for each level of the job, one. Two, You're not just going to have a card-carrying member of the NWSA saying, I'm certified to be Tower Tech 1, 2, 3, 4. You're also going to have a database where somebody can look up their certifications. Three, there's going to be a credentialing system put in place where someone can look it up and verify it. So they're coming up with all these stopgaps that, and we get into this in panel three as well, but they're coming up with a lot of stopgaps that's going to prevent the certification problem. Believe me, I hear it a lot. I hear it from a lot of people that hire these climbers and they don't know jack. In all honesty, they're just poorly trained. Maybe they know how to climb, but that's about it. Maybe they come in saying they know steel, and all they really know about steel is the difference between, you know, an angled leg and a round member. So Michael then brought up another comment, which Aaron read. I was sent to test a company's site with two climbers. Oh, this is great. I'm sorry, I got excited. I'm calming down now. Okay, I'm going to calm down. Michael then brought up another comment, which Aaron read. I was sent to a company site with two climbers. And when I got there, he was working with two climbers. When we got to the site, one of the two climbers had 2 weeks of experience, but had only climbed one time. And the other climber had been hired the day before. Climber B, the one hired the day before, decided he didn't want to do this job anymore and quit on site. And climber A, with 2 weeks experience, belted it up and started climbing up the tower, but had trouble with the safety climb about 60 foot up. Climber B exhausted himself trying to figure out how to get his safety climb sleeve past the bracket. I had to go up and rescue climber A. Now, the guy I was the was the guy that was supposed to sweep the lines, okay? I had to go up and rescue climber A. No, I lost my place. Sorry, people. With 2 weeks of experience. Oh, anyways, climber A. Okay, he had to go up and rescue the climber, basically. Climber B exhausted himself trying to figure out how to climb past the safety bracket. So basically, this guy, I'm going to just sum it up. This guy had to teach them how to use the SiteMaster, right? And then he had to climb because he was a climber. And all you climbers that think, I've done my time, let the new guys go up. You know, I get that to a point, but you should really go up together. But basically, this guy had to do all the work so these two bozos could sweep the line. He had to talk them through how to do that. And he says it's a regular occurrence. Anyway, Dr. Hester said that she gets this call from a lot of people in the field, that most climbers are so poorly trained, they're not trained at all, and they just go out and they do it anyway. And she's hoping that TIRAP corrects problems like these. And Richard said he also sees things like this in the field, where many times they send the on-trained climber up because the older climbers feel they have done their time. When you climb a lot, it is nice to take a break, but you got to really think of the safety of the crew too. So Nick says that he sees that often. He says many times these new guys could be the problem, and it gets worse. It could cause more fatalities, and Dr. Hester said that they are often just passed from company to company. They quit one or they get fired, they just go to another company. Next. The next issue was brought up was weather. Sorry. So there were two comments. Basically, I'm going to just sum it up. They work in all kinds of weather, and this guy that wrote the comment says that they shouldn't have to work in all kinds of weather. They should be allowed to refuse work. And the next comment said, weather is a major contributor to safely working on towers. Contractors in the north deal with every weather condition possible throughout the year. There doesn't seem to be any standard out there for, you know, rain, weather, temperatures, and so on. You get the gist, right? So Nick basically said that weather is an issue, but it's hard to have a standard because he said he climbs in Florida. To him, 50 degrees is cold, right? They don't deal with the same things. However, in Florida, you have high winds, you have a lot of rain, and you also have tornadoes down there. So someone in the north would have to deal with ice, snow, freezing temperatures, along with the rain and then the heat in the summer, you know, all that. But he also said that someone in North Dakota would have very different weather conditions. So you got to think about that. You can't really set a standard because there's no standard in the country. Are you going to tell people in North Dakota they don't have to climb when it's below 32 degrees Fahrenheit? They never climb. That wipes out 8 months of work. So then Richard said that it should be a competent person on the job site making the call. You need to have someone out there that can make the call. And Dr. Hester said that people often try to cancel the work, but it needs to get done, and the manager often requires them to do it or they lose their job. Craig said that weather can't stop you from working. The environment will never be perfect, but you can do it safely. Hey, in all honesty, I climbed a lot in the rain. I broke a lot of ice off towers to complete the climb. I've climbed in snow. Snow gets slick. I mean, snow's a little scary. Freezing rain is freaky. I would not climb in freezing rain. because you just don't know what's going to happen. Not only that, but your safety gear becomes highly limited when the rain's freezing because it starts to break, if you know what I'm talking about. I've seen those conditions. So that's my note. Next, Aaron read a question from the audience. What do you believe will be able to help with those timelines, going back to the timeline issue and the scheduling issue? So Richard said that the process with permitting issues have to be streamlined. And then he also mentioned that consultants had a lot of delays because they often questioned the safety of the tower. He pointed out while the tower is inspected by the tower owner, they do not do safety inspections because he said that is a responsibility of the contractor, not the tower owner. The tower owner often needs to correct tower issues. He said that often the restrictions are put on them by the consultants that add delays to the deployment. Okay, there's another conundrum. Here you have Richard, who works for Crown Castle, basically stating that safety is up to the contractor, not to the tower owner. I mean, everyone was sort of taken back by that. I think it's a, you know, we talk about a team effort, a culture of safety, and here you have the tower owner saying, not my problem. That's the way I took it. I'm not saying that's how he meant it. I'm saying that's how I took it, personally. Of course, you couldn't say anything there. So anyway, then an audience member asked about the oversight of training. Does it need to be escalated to a higher level? Nick said that the level of training is critical and the lack of consistency is a problem in the industry. There will be a formal approach to the certifications in the industry, which is basically, Craig talked about TIRAP and NWSA and the partnership that they formed, basically aligning the apprenticeship along with the training. So that's a good thing. And he also mentioned that the industry is quickly moving towards standardization of training. And that's what the NWSA is really going to do. And that's what TIRAP's in the process of doing. So then Michael's next question, he stated that there isn't one contractor here today that hasn't worked, you know, 2 weeks straight, 10 to 12 hours a day. He said that the industry has few limits on work schedules. He brought up that this is basically a comment he read. He brought up the trucking industry and how they limit the number of hours that they drive. Basically, I don't know if you guys know, this is my comment. I don't know if you guys know any truckers out there, but they have to log their time. They're limited by how many hours they drive. They do all that for safety. All that is done with safety in mind. So then Dr. Hester said that the management has full control and they have them work at long hours. You know, basically management tells them when to work. And she said it really has a wearing factor, wears a climber down. Their mentality gets really beat down by that. And it's really not part of safety. She said they really need to instill that safety culture. Michael responded asking that the safeguard could be put into implemented this change, which I think a logbook, that's my opinion. I think if we had logbooks for these guys to log their climb time, their high time, their ground time, but for some reason, a lot of you climbers push back saying, oh, I fill out my time sheet, that's enough. And I know what it is. You don't want to do any more paperwork. You know, protect yourself, guys. All right, my comment's done. Richard basically said that the employer's responsible and pointed out how Dave Anthony stayed close to home to work because he said travel's a problem. He said that when he'd climb, he was going for 3 weeks at a time. He'd be home for 1 week. And that is how the industry used to be. I'm assuming it's still like that. I mean, I would leave for a week. You know, I'd leave Monday or Sunday and come home Friday night or Saturday morning. That's just how it was. But then Craig said that he understood the dilemma, but he stated that the truck driver on the road could kill many other people, but a tower climber will really only injure himself. I guess he was stating he didn't really like the idea of limiting the number of hours you can climb. He pointed out that everyone works long hours. In fact, Michael, you know, sent email out like 9 o'clock at night on Sunday night. He said it's part of life. He said that every industry works hard in long hours. They have to learn how to manage it in a safe way. Richard then said his crew worked long hours and they took breaks and did other things. Dr. Hester then mentioned how there are other issues that it affects climbers, being away from home for a long time, the mental breakdown, the depression, things like that, she said. And she wants to make sure that the climbers are healthy. Back to what Craig said about, you know, it's a dilemma that the truck drivers can hurt other people. I don't know, man. I think the idea is to save any life. I think every life is valuable. I know what he's saying. He's saying a truck driver can, you know, take out 10 other cars if he's going fast enough. And I know it happens. The other thing is, with the climber, when you're doing stuff every day, it's physically exhausting. And this is my comment. My comment is, it's physically exhausting. It's not like, and I'm not busting on truck drivers, because what a truck driver does, he drives for a long time, which really wears me down. I'm going to be honest with you. Then he has to load or unload the truck in some cases. What a tower climber has to do, in every case, a tower climber has to drive somewhere, whether it's 1 hour or 6 hours. And I've done both. I've done 10 hours. I think I've done a 12-hour drive. Then you have to climb, which is very physical. You have to worry about your safety. And when I say safety, not just for the drive, You have to worry about safety for gearing up for the tower. You have to hope you have everything. You have to do inventory. You have to make sure everything's there. If something's not there, you have to figure out how to get it. And you usually do that when you're down and done, like in the evening or first thing in the morning. Depends when you go. Yeah, I used to go to Lowe's or Home Depot a lot. Bought a lot of stuff. And when I say a lot of stuff, not just hardware, but garbage bags, brackets, you know, everything. I used to go to Walmart to buy clothes because sometimes you're out a week for you're out of town for 2 weeks instead of one. So I really think you should log your high time. I really think every climber should log their high time, their drive time, their work time, their ground time, their project, who they're working for. And I know you guys push back on that. I get it. You hate the paperwork. I get it. I'm tired of paperwork, but I write this stuff up to help you guys. So spit in my face. I'll get over it. So then Aaron asked another audience question. She asked about who pays to make the tower safety safer if there is an obstruction, or like if you need a man lift or a crane, you know, if there's a T-arm on the tower. Now, Nick said that you can go in there with a crane or a man basket, but someone will have to pay for it. It costs more money. And he said, chances are there's someone else who will do it without the man crane or the lift. Then Craig said that it would be wonderful if the carriers could get together and come up with joint standards for any projects that have rules around a fair bidding process. I could get into that. Let me explain this. The way the bidding works for a carrier, you bid on like 1,000 sites, and Nick gets into that at some point. I hope I didn't miss it. Yeah, but you have thousands of sites. They can't worry about everyone with a man lift. What we need to do is have them accept change orders. The change order process is what needs to do it. And I know the tower owners don't want anything to do with safety from that perspective. They think the contractor should do it. Let me tell you something. If a tower needs a lift or a crane, I would think the tower owner would know that. My opinion. Maybe they don't, but come on. They have to inspect these towers. Moving on, the next question. Michael asked another question about 2013 and 2014 were busy. 2015 was not. Fatality injuries go directly with carrier expenditures, meaning that there are unqualified workers when there's work, you know, when there's a lot of work. So if the work picks up again, you know, this one guy says here, do you think that vetting and putting more questions in place would reduce injuries? He's never seen in 17 years a safety line item on a bid. This is a comment coming in, remember. The second question goes like this. A tower owner states that the contractor is responsible to know the tower is safe. How can a third party possibly do this when they're not qualified to know if the structure is safe or not? They don't know that the safety climb is broken at 200 feet up the tower. There should be a federal mandate that the tower owner should inspect the tower every 5 years. Basically a question. Richard responded by stating that TIS states that they have to inspect the tower structures every 5 or 7 years, depending if it's a self-supporter, a monopole, or a guide tower. They're responsible for problems like the safety climb. But how can they be, are they responsible is what I should have said here. He basically said, are they responsible for problems like a safety climb that's not connected 200 foot up? I mean, how do they know that? They also hire contractors to do the work. If a contractor does not do the safety climb properly, then they are criminally negligent. But how does it really, I get his point here. What he's basically saying is they trust a contractor to do the work. If the guy screws it up, they should be criminally negligent. But how do they know that if you don't report it? My note is, if you see a problem on a tower like that, call the NOC, report it. Make a note that you reported it. And if you have to, if you feel it's unsafe, call OSHA. Call OSHA and say, hey, I'm at such and such tower. This is an unsafe work condition. All right. So Nick thinks there has to be a better way to vet contractors, obviously. I think that goes without saying. Now, Craig's answer was about TIA 222, okay? You have G and you have F, take your pick. But he said basically all these questions are answered in TIA 222 and 1019A, and the contractors need to read these documents and spend the money on these documents, because he said a common feedback is that a lot of these people say $700, I'm not spending the money, and I get that. But then Nick, and he went on and on. So then Nick basically answered that the everyday tower dog's not going to take the time to read hundreds of pages or have it with him at the site. So then Craig said that reading is required. He was implying that all these tower climbers need to read this document. All the crew owners should read at least TIA 222G. That's what he's implying. And probably 1019A. So that was the point there. So there I summed it up, and I'm sorry if I got anything wrong or misquoted anybody or read things the wrong way. Sorry about that, but finally, we have the closing comments. So Craig said he wasn't crazy about, he likes the idea of enforcement, but he said it is necessary. We're going to have to do it. And the FCC and OSHA need to keep enforcing the rules. Richard followed up with an agreement with Craig, and then he stated that action matters. They have to take action. And then he went on to thank the leadership of Crown Castle for being an advocate, for having him be an advocate for safety in the industry. He appreciated that. And Nick basically said it doesn't see enforcement as being feasible because of how spread out the site and the works are, which again, I think the audits can take care of that if we build better schedules, in my opinion. Sorry, Nick. But basically, he said it will be too late till they get there. You know, he basically responded saying enforcement's not practical, that it's up to the company to train each individual properly. And Dr. Hester agrees that we need to get great training, and also that if we could have a third party track the problems, now with big data, we could do that. We could have someone track the problems. I think we could do that with the work. I mean, I know the work's spread out and everything, but if we schedule things properly, we should be able to track where all the work is. And then we can do safety audits, randomly hit the sites. It's just the way it should be. Remember that the FCC and OSHA are your friends. Remember that OSHA has a number to report emergency problems, a fatality, anything like that. It's 800-321-OSHA, which is 800-321-6742. And they're also taking public comments for safety and on safety and management. And if you want to see the video, the workshop, I have it, the OSHA compliant website for non-emergencies. So OSHA does have a website where you can complain about non-emergencies, which I would highly recommend doing. All right, everybody. I have all my links in there. Again, I do have a log for your job, for your high time and drive time. It's a spreadsheet. I have a scope of work tutorial, which we do that. And if you're listening to this on iTunes, leave me a review. I do appreciate you listening. And again, I also support the Hubble Foundation. Thanks, everyone. Be smart, be safe, and pay attention to what you're doing, because that could be the difference between life and death. Seriously. Most people don't like to hear that, but it matters. It really does. I don't know why people think that's a silly saying, but be smart, be safe, and pay attention. See ya.